Davenport's note had said they would be meeting at his home, but Anya didn't expect that meant anything casual, so she wasn't surprised when they pulled up to an estate that looked as if it probably doubled the entire state of Rhode Island. A thick protective wall ran around the entire complex, and entrance to the property was gained through a tall iron gate, complete with a set of armed guards. Inside, it was like entering another world. Wide green lawns stretched out as far as the eye could see, with the grass and the endless variety of bushes and trees all carefully tended and landscaped. In the distance, a group of horses grazed, and Anya had no doubt that the bloodlines of those beasts were as pure as money could buy. The driveway twisted and turned, occasionally obscuring her view of the horses behind the trunks of age-old oaks. And then they rounded a corner, and the house itself was revealed ahead of them. A vast, sprawling structure in saltillo tile and whitewashed stucco, complete with a flower-draped fountain in the center of the driveway. As Jose brought the car to a halt, the door opened, and Mason Jones appeared at the top of the steps in the company of an older gentleman with silver-gray hair and a long, narrow face. The severity of the man's features, however, was broken by the deep blue of his eyes and the playful smile that splashed across his face. Anya recognized him at once.
John Davenport.
The two men descended the steps and waited for Jose to help her out of the vehicle. Mason performed the introductions.
Anya Creed, here you are at last.
It's a pleasure to meet you.
Davenport's smile seemed to grow wider, if that was at all possible, as he took her hand.
I assure you, lovely lady, the pleasure is all mine. Thank you for coming, and welcome to my humble home.
Home, maybe. Humble, new.
Anya simply smiled at her host. Davenport turned and led her into the house.
I hope you like beef. I've had my chef prepare some fresh steaks from our organically fed Argentinian cattle. It is absolutely fabulous.
Dinner was excellent, and through it all, Davenport kept the conversation light and entertaining. It wasn't until well into the meal that Anya realized he would make an excellent interrogator. Davenport had subtly drawn her out on all manner of subjects, from her taste in music to the difficulties of working a dig in the midst of the jungle. She hadn't even been aware she'd been letting him direct the conversation for so long. Talking to him felt like the most natural thing in the world, and Anya could see why he'd become as wealthy as he had. Anyone who spent 5 minutes in a room alone with him would come out feeling like they were old friends, and it was simply human nature that friends wanted to help each other. She had little doubt that Davenport had built his empire on the strength of that personality. Once the table was cleared and the servants had left the room, Davenport finally got down to business.
Thank you for coming tonight. I'm sure you've been wondering why I've asked you here. The truth of the matter is that I could use some help with a special project, and after our conversation this evening, I'm more convinced than ever that you're just the person to provide it.
I'd be happy to help you in any way I can.
Tell me, how familiar are you with Genghis Khan?
Born in Mongolia in 1162, his given name was Temujin, and he was named for a warrior slain by his father, one who exhibited bravery in that final confrontation. Declared himself ruler of the Mongol Empire in 1206 and died in 1227. In between, he created an empire 4 times larger than Alexander the Great's, from the Chinese coastline to the Black Sea, and from India all the way to the Arctic Circle. He managed to assemble a nation out of a handful of warring tribes and held them together with nothing more than his iron will. A man to be reckoned with, in my view.
I should have known better than to think I'd catch the host of chasing history's monsters without the facts at her fingertips. Since you're the expert on monsters, tell me, was Genghis Khan the bloodthirsty conqueror that the media today has made him out to be? A man bent solely on rape, murder, and mayhem?
Conqueror? Yes. Bloodthirsty? That depends on your viewpoint, I guess. It's true, legend says that he once slaughtered an entire city. Men, women, children, and livestock, in retaliation for the death of his grandson. It is also said that he used the bodies of captured enemy soldiers to fill the siege trenches so that his troops could get close enough to breach the walls. But was that any different from what the Crusaders did during the siege of Jerusalem, not to mention what they did to the Cathars at Béziers?
I suppose not, but we don't generally think of the Crusaders as savage marauders hell-bent on ruining civilization.
No, but perhaps we should. They did more damage and far less good than Genghis Khan did, and yet his people have come down through the ages being referred to as the Mongol Horde. How's that for an epitaph?
Well, not one I'd choose for myself, that's for sure.
Davenport paused as the servants came back into the room to serve coffee. Accepting a cup, Anya inhaled the heady aroma and took a sip. It was strong enough to knock your socks off, which was just the way she liked it. Once the help had withdrawn, Davenport set his cup on the table.
I'm considering putting together an expedition to find the Khan's lost tomb.
Don't bother.
Anya didn't even glance up from her drink, so she missed the quick flicker of surprise that flashed across Davenport's face.
Why not?
Because he more than likely didn't have one.
You seem pretty sure of yourself.
I am.
Why is that?
Because in the first place, the Mongol people didn't believe in tombs. Remember that the Mongols were a nomadic people, both before and after Genghis Khan united them as a single political body. They had few cities, and those they did have were for the purpose of storing war booty, not settling down and raising a family.
Mm-hmm, go on.
Because the Mongols moved from place to place, their religious beliefs evolved very much along similar lines. They considered the natural world to be full of spirits, much like the animists of feudal Japan. For instance, they were forbidden from bathing in rivers or streams because such places were considered the lifeblood of the earth itself, and doing so would have been a horrible affront to the land. A Mongol warrior's greatest possession was his spirit banner. It was made by tying strands of hair from his best horses to the shaft of a spear. Whenever he made camp, the warrior would place the spirit banner outside the entrance to his tent to show his presence and to stand as a perpetual guardian. Over time, the union between the warrior and the banner became so strong that, upon the warrior's death, his soul was considered to reside in the banner and not the body.
But Genghis Khan was not just any warrior. He was the spiritual father and warlord of the Mongol people. Just like people today, they would have wanted a place to remember him.
They had one. The spirit banner. It rode with the Khan's descendants until 1647, when it was placed in the Shank Monastery for safekeeping.
So you're saying the Mongol people didn't need a tomb because Genghis Khan's very soul rode alongside them wherever they went? Interesting. What if I told you that the legends were true? That the Mongols did build a secret tomb for their great Khan? That they filled it with an amazingly diverse treasure trove, loot from the hundreds of cultures he conquered? And what if I said I had in my possession the journal of a man who had intimate details of the burial process itself? A journal that contained a map to the location of the tomb.
I'd say you'd better hire someone to authenticate the map and the writings pretty darn quick, because whatever you paid for it, it was too much. You've been had. Hell, I'd be happy to do it for you myself, just to prove to you the ridiculousness of the very idea.
Good. Then that's settled. You can start first thing in the morning.
Anya stared at him blankly for a moment, and then it dawned on her that she had been neatly led right where Davenport had wanted her to go. Well, she'd just have to take the job and show him how wrong he was. After what had happened, she knew the dig was all but finished for the season. She'd simply give them a call and let them know she was going home early.
A map to the tomb of Genghis Khan? Ridiculous.
The next morning, Anya rose shortly after sunrise and decided to get some exercise before she returned to Davenport's estate to view the artifact he claimed showed the way to Genghis Khan's tomb. Digging a pair of shorts and a t-shirt out of her bag, she threw on her sneakers and headed out to Chapultepec Park for a run. Maybe it was the early hour, or possibly the anticipation of the work she was going to do that afternoon to prove Davenport wrong, but whatever the reason, Anya failed to spot the tail she picked up the moment she walked out of the hotel. The man assigned to watch her was good. He stayed out of her visual area, sticking to the blind spots to the sides and the rear, and hung back enough that were she to stop suddenly, he'd have plenty of time to react to the change of pace and act accordingly. He needn't have worried, however, for the woman was too distracted to even notice him. When she wandered into the park and began a series of stretches intended to loosen up her muscles for a run, the man knew it was now or never. He pulled a cell phone out of his pocket and dialed a number. Back in the lobby of the hotel, a second individual answered the call, listened briefly, then hung up and headed for the elevator. It took the operative less than 10 seconds to pick the lock on the woman's hotel room door and slip inside, closing the door gently behind him. He stood with his back to it for a moment, listening. His partner had said the woman was alone, but it still paid to be careful. He hated these rush jobs. Too little information meant too many potential ways that things could go wrong. You didn't argue with the boss, though. When he wanted something done, you did it, no questions asked. Simple as that. He'd seen what happened to people who questioned orders, and once was all it took to convince him never to do anything so foolish. Satisfied that the woman was staying alone and he wouldn't be interrupted, the operative threw caution to the wind and went to work, quickly and efficiently tossing the place, searching for the objects he'd been instructed to find. He was an old hand at this kind of work, and he took his time, methodically moving from room to room, mentally noting the position of every object before he moved it, and putting it back in the exact same spot when he was finished. He'd come in like a ghost, and he intended to go out the same way, leaving nothing behind, not even the slightest clue to indicate anything out of the ordinary had happened. By the time his partner called, letting him know the woman had finished her run and was getting ready to leave the park, he had covered every square inch of the suite and was confident that he'd missed nothing. The trouble was, he hadn't found what he was looking for either. Reluctantly, he withdrew his cell phone from the inside pocket of his jacket and dialed a number.
Yes?
They're not here.
You're certain?
The operative didn't need to be told what would happen to him if he turned out to be wrong. The implied threat in the man's tone was somehow more frightening than if he'd come right out and said something.
Yes, I'm certain.
He listened for a moment, nodding in agreement with what was said, even though there was no one there to see him do it, and then lifted the business card he'd found among the woman's personal effects.
Creed, Anya. A-N-N-J-A, Anya Creed.
He listened for another moment and then closed the phone. There was no need to say goodbye. His employer had already hung up. The operative took one last look around to make certain he hadn't left anything out of place, and then slipped out of the room as quietly as he had entered. Anya entered her hotel room in a rush, knowing she had very little time left to get cleaned up before Davenport's car arrived to take her to the estate. She'd only gotten halfway across the living room, however, when she stopped abruptly, her senses screaming.
Someone's been in the room.
Nothing was disturbed. Everything looked as if it was right where it had been when she'd left for her run half an hour earlier. Yet she had the definite sense that someone had been there in her absence. She stood still and listened, trying to determine if anyone was hiding in the bedroom just beyond, but she couldn't hear anything unusual. She reached out with her right hand. Cautiously, she walked forward and peeked around the doorframe into the bedroom, ready to pull her head back at a moment's notice if there was anyone there. The room was empty.
You're getting paranoid. No one even knows you're in Mexico City.
Still, she checked the bathroom and the closets just to be safe. When they turned out to be as empty as the bedroom, she at last allowed herself to relax and release the sword back into the otherwhere.
Probably just the maid.
But as she pulled off her sweaty clothes and headed for the shower, she couldn't quite convince herself of that. Mason was waiting when she arrived at the estate, and after a quick hello, he led her upstairs to a room on the second floor where Davenport was waiting. A long table stood in the center of the room, surrounded by a variety of scientific equipment. Anya glanced at them and then made a beeline for the glass case sitting in the middle of the table. Inside was a small leather-bound book, with yellowed pages and a cracked and faded cover. She turned, acknowledging her employer for the first time since entering the room.
Is this it?
And a good morning to you, too, Anya. And yes, that is it, as you say. That little volume is going to lead us to the treasure of the centuries.
If it's authentic. What can you tell me about it?
In 1245, Pope Innocent IV, suspicious of the lingering power of the Mongols, sent a diplomatic party to the court of Gayuk, Genghis Khan's grandson, at Karakoram. Leading that party was a friar by the name of Giovanni Dapian del Carpini.
Anya nodded. She was aware of Carpini's journey and the book he'd written upon his return. The Story of the Mongols, whom we call the Tartars. It was one of the first European accounts of life in the Mongol Empire. It was still considered an important historical document.
With Carpini went a priest by the name of Father Michael Curran. Curran was a rising star, one of the Vatican's inner circle, if you will, and was there at the direct order of the Pope himself.
To do what?
Spy on the Mongols, of course. Remember, it had been less than 25 years since Genghis Khan's army had turned back at the Saryo River, rather than continue his conquest of Hungary and the rest of Eastern Europe. I'm sure more than just the Pope was wondering when or if Guy Yok was going to try again.
So this book...
It is Curran's personal account of his time among the Mongols.
If Curran reported what he learned to the Pope, why has the tomb remained undiscovered all this time?
That's just it. Curran never had the chance to tell anyone what he learned, least of all the Pope. He never made it out of Mongolia.
Apparently, the group Curran was traveling with was attacked by a rival clan while deep within the Forbidden Zone, an area deep in the heart of the Empire that the relatives of Genghis Khan had set aside forever as a monument to his glory. Curran managed to survive the attack itself, along with one other man. Badly wounded and left for dead, the two of them sought shelter in a mountain cave. That's where Curran learned the location of the Khan's tomb from his dying companion. Unfortunately for Curran, a winter storm trapped them in the cave for several weeks, and he eventually succumbed to his wounds before he could make his way back to Karakoram.
Mason gestured at the diary.
It's all in there. His impressions of Karakoram, his audience with Gayuk, the attack on the convoy, his ruminations as he lay dying all but alone in that cave.
Knowing that the little book in the case before her contained the last thoughts of a man who had died cold and in a place far from home made her view it with even more respect than she had before. Still, something about Mason's story bothered her.
How do you know Curran's companion wasn't lying? That it wasn't all some fever dream brought on by his impending death?
Well, actually, I don't. But nor do I have to prove that, at least not yet. All I need to know right now is whether or not the diary is the right age to actually be Curran's. Once we determine that, we can worry about the rest. First things first.
I guess that means I'd best get to work.
With the two men watching, Anya placed her backpack on the table next to the case and unzipped it. Inside were a digital SLR camera and a laptop computer. Both pieces of equipment had seen their fair share of adventures at her side, and she'd come to rely on them in more ways than one. She took out the laptop and started it up, then connected the camera to it. She fired off a few shots of the lab around her just to test the connection. Satisfied that all was working the way it should, she put the camera down and turned back to her pack. Anya fished out a pair of white cotton gloves from a side pocket of the bag and pulled them on. The soft material would protect the brittleness of the pages, as well as provide a barrier between them and her skin, keeping the damaging oil from her fingertips from doing the journal any harm. She might think it was a fake, but she'd treat it as authentic until she could prove otherwise. For the same reason, she laid out a wide piece of silk on the tabletop in front of her.
May I?
Be my guest.
She opened the small brass clasp holding the case closed and lifted the lid. Reaching inside, she drew out the slim volume and set it down in the area she had prepared. Just like that, she was lost in the work. Discovering a new artifact, tracing its lineage, verifying its authenticity, it still moved and inspired her in ways that few other things could. Her awareness of the other people in the room faded as she gave herself completely to the task in front of her. Anya picked up the camera and used it to take a full-size color photo of every single page in the book. She did the same with the inside and outside cover pages, both front and back. The pictures were immediately downloaded onto the laptop and organized sequentially. This would allow her to view the entire work without the need to handle the book itself, eliminating the possibility, no matter how slim, of it being damaged in the process. It would also let her magnify various sections, something she couldn't do if she were working solely from the original. Once she was finished, she put the camera away and replaced the journal in its protective case. Pulling up a chair, she settled in front of the laptop and began reading. Anya was quickly engrossed in her work, so much so that she never even noticed when Davenport gestured to Mason, and the two of them slipped out of the room behind her back. The book had been written in Latin, in a thin, spidery script. The pages were faded, and in some cases heavily stained, making it difficult to understand certain passages. But for a 700-year-old book, it was remarkably well-preserved. She began to read. The book was exactly what Davenport had claimed, the personal journal of a man who'd endured a long and arduous journey deep into the Mongolian steppes on behalf of the church. Curran was an excellent writer, and she soon found herself drawn into the story itself. She could sense the man's loneliness, could feel his determination to do the job right and return home. She even ached along with him when his only companion succumbed to his wounds and died in the middle of the night. Curran's death must have been sudden, for he hadn't made any reference to the coming end in his journal. One day he was writing about trying to dig himself out, and then the next, nothing. She read through the entire work once, start to finish, looking for glaring problems that would instantly tell her the document was a fake. When she didn't find any, she settled in for a more detailed examination. The first thing she did was look for historical inaccuracies. Not only were Curran's observations correct, as nearly as she could tell, such as the location of Gayuk's summer encampment and the establishment of trade with parts of China, but they contained many small details that the average forger more than likely wouldn't be aware of at all. Things like the stench that hung over the Mongol army at all times in the field, due to their reluctance to bathe in rivers and streams, or the way Mongol horsemen would smear their exposed skin with yak grease to take the bite out of the winter wind on the high plains. She stopped looking for historical errors after a few hours and turned instead to linguistic ones. Language grows and changes, just like any other organic element, and a good historian can also spot a forgery by the way certain words or phrases are used within a text. Anya struck out there, too. Her doubts about the authenticity of the manuscript were starting to take a beating in the face of what she was reading. So far, the manuscript had passed every test. Knowing she'd been at it for hours, she got up and stretched a bit. She noticed a small serving tray had been left by the door at some point, and lifting the lid, she discovered a plate of turkey sandwiches, complete with cranberry sauce and a bed of lettuce, along with a soft drink that was still icy cold. She gratefully dug in. When she finished eating, she decided to give the text a rest and turn her attention to the map that had been hand-drawn in the back of the journal. She was in the midst of rereading the document for the sixth or seventh time when she saw a key piece of the puzzle. Several words on the page started with a funny little curlicue, as if the writer had left the pen on the page for a few seconds too long. At first, she thought it was just an artifact of the particular pen the author had used. Perhaps its point hadn't been cut properly, and the ink had pooled where it shouldn't have. But then she began to notice that there wasn't a consistency to its appearance. On one page, a word starting with the letter T would have the little curlicue, but two pages later, the same word would not. Curious, she went back to the beginning and began to flip through the images of each page, looking for the strange little mark. Her trained eye began to pick out a pattern to its occurrences, something a little less than random.
That's interesting.
Grabbing a piece of paper, she went back to the beginning of the text again, but this time she wrote down every word where the strange mark appeared. She listed them in a vertical column, one after another, until she had reached the end. Scanning down the list, she quickly noted that the words seemed to form sentences, and so she rewrote them in horizontal lines instead, guessing where one sentence left off and another one began. When she was finished, she was left with several paragraphs of text. Her eyes widened as she realized what they were. They came over the wall like ghosts. They didn't hesitate once they were on the ground on the other side, but rather set off immediately for their objective, unconcerned with any of the defensive measures around the house. The Mastiffs caught their scent within seconds of their appearance on this side of the wall. Trained to silently advance and render intruders immobile, the massive dogs moved through the darkness. The lead man caught sight of the dogs as they came around the corner of the house. Seconds after the dogs came into view, the sniper team went into operation. The tranquilizer darts took another few seconds to work, so the dogs had closed to within 15 feet of the lead man before they faltered and then crashed to the ground, unconscious. Ignoring them, the team raced on. The intruders made it halfway across the lawn before the dogs' handlers came around the side of the house on their usual patrol route. The handlers had only just begun to process the fact that their charges were nowhere to be seen when the team in the trees fired again. Unconscious, the handlers dropped into the grass before they even knew what hit them. The motion sensors and floodlights came next. A swath of earth 20 feet in width had been seeded with pressure plates attached to a series of high-intensity lights that were intended to blind and disorient intruders who made it past the dogs. The specific section of the lawn containing the sensors looked no different than any other, and an ordinary intruder would have been hard-pressed to get beyond it. But as they had already demonstrated, this was no ordinary group of intruders. The lead man never slowed. He charged into the designated area, his eyes on the wall that was getting closer with every step, confident that the sensors had been disarmed. No sirens split the night. No lights forced back the darkness. The lead man reached the outside wall of the manor house. Unslinging the grapple gun from where he carried it across his back, he took aim and fired. The small steel hook shot upward, arced over the edge of the roof, and embedded itself in the tiles high above. A sharp tug on the climbing rope attached to the hook confirmed its placement. Hand over hand, the lead man and two others climbed to the roof, while the final two men in the team took up positions at the bottom of the rope, guarding the escape route for the others. Once on the rooftop, they followed the route that they had all committed to memory, moving from their initial entry point at the end of the south wing to a section of the roof above the main manor house. Their leader used the four chimneys to orient the team and then advanced to a spot midway along the roof's western edge. At his signal, his two companions began pulling up the roofing tiles and stacking them to one side. When they had created a space large enough for a man to fit through, one of them stepped to the side. The lead man, who by now had assembled a portable cutting rig from parts removed from his pack, passed the rig to his waiting companion. The item they had come for was less than 15 feet away, separated from them by just a thin section of plaster and wood. The leader glanced at his watch. They were right on time. He gave the signal for his teammate to start cutting. Anya found Mason and his employer in Davenport's study on the first floor. She wasted no time in getting to the point.
If Curran died in that cave, who found the journal and how did you come to be in possession of it?
Mason glanced at Davenport and the other man nodded, giving permission for him to answer the question.
I handle a variety of jobs for Mr. Davenport. One of those happens to be scouting out new business opportunities. I was in Mongolia recently with a geological team looking for mineral deposits. While investigating a series of caves a few days outside of Karakoram, we stumbled upon the mummified remains of two men. The journal was on a shelf near one of the bodies.
And so you took it?
I thought it might be important, and taking it with me seemed the best way of preserving it.
But now that you've had time to examine its contents, surely you understand that the site, and anything it contains, could be of historic importance to the Mongolian people?
Of course we do, Anya. But we also want credit for finding the site and permission to excavate it. That is why we intend to apply for the proper paperwork to sponsor an expedition to do just that in the spring. Determining the authenticity of the journal seemed an important step in that process.
Anya wasn't sure if that was the whole story or not, but she recognized that it was all she was going to get at the moment.
Good enough. Then I guess it's okay to tell you. I think it's real.
Aha! I knew it! I just knew it!
Mason was up, shaking his employer's hand.
I said I think the journal is real. Unfortunately, the map is not.
What do you mean the map is not?
Anya brought her laptop over to the table in front of the chairs where they'd been seated and turned it around to face them.
This is a full-scale image of the map from the back of the journal. I cleaned it up some, but otherwise it is exactly the same. No image enhancements or anything like that.
The two men nodded to show they were following her.
Now, this is a modern-day map of the same area. I've reduced it to scale to match the other one.
The two maps appeared side by side. Davenport glanced between them.
I don't see... Oh.
Yeah. Oh.
Anya tapped the keyboard, and they all watched as the two images slid over each other. Doing so allowed them to see that Curran, or whoever had drawn the map, had deliberately introduced errors into the positioning of many of the major landmarks. For instance, the Onan River had been moved slightly to the east, while the Hentin Nuru mountain range had been relocated a good distance to the south. The other errors were similar in nature. Anya had counted 11 in all.
Why would he do that?
He wanted to pass on the information, but didn't want to make it easy in case it fell into the wrong hands. Remember, there's no way for anyone at that time to verify the map short of going there themselves. So a few subtle alterations and voila, the secret is safe.
Oh, so the maps are fake. It won't lead us to the tomb.
The map's authentic, all right. In the sense that it is as old as we expected it to be, and more than likely penned by the individual we think penned it. The thing is, it just doesn't give accurate directions to the tomb. At least, not directly. The location of the tomb is in there. We just have to break the code to get it.
Code?
Let me show you.
Anya closed out the maps and brought up several pages from the journal itself.
Do you see the extra little figure on this word? And this word? And this? This figure is repeated on words throughout the journal. When those are pulled out and put together, this is what you get. Beneath the watchful gaze of the eternal blue heaven, the spirit of the warrior points the way to where the blood of the world intertwines and the voice in the earth has its say. The 60 brides rode 60 steeds and now rest beneath the watchful eyes of those who came before. In their arms is the truth you seek, the way to all that was and more. Then climb to the place where Tiengri and Ghazan meet. It is there that the Botter makes his home.
What the heck is that?
I'm not 100% sure, but if I had to guess, I'd say it is probably directions to the final resting place of Genghis Khan himself.
Do you think you can decipher it?
I've worked through the first stanza already, I think, and I've got some ideas about the others. But understand, there's no way to be certain. We could get all the way there, only to discover I was wrong about the first part, which would then call the rest of the solution into question as well. It's a crapshoot.
Anya didn't miss the look that passed between the two men.
Let's say, just for the sake of argument, that I can figure it out. What then?
What then? Why, we go after it, of course. In fact, we'd better start making plans to do so now. The off-season is coming on quickly over there, so we'll have to wait until spring, of course. But that will give us time to get things organized and allow you a chance to work out the puzzle to your satisfaction before we leave the country. We'll need to get travel and dig permits from the Mongolian authorities, arrange for local guides and transportation, never mind choosing the right individuals to be a part of the dig team.
Davenport must have seen something in her face in reaction to that last statement, for he suddenly turned to her with a grin.
You are coming along, right?
With a start, Anya realized she did want to go. Very badly, in fact. Working with the map and diary had fired her desire to follow this thing to the end, to see if there was any truth to the words Father Curran had so faithfully recorded all those years ago. She'd been to a lot of places across the globe, but Mongolia wasn't one of them. And being able to take part in the search to uncover one of the world's greatest mysteries was the chance of a lifetime. Doing something like this was why she had become an archaeologist in the first place. There was no way she would pass it up. Besides, she'd have her producer at Chasing History's Monsters, Doug Morrell, eating out of her hand for months if they pulled this one off.
When do we leave?
Outside in the grass, one of the dog handlers, Kyle Davis, stirred. He'd come into work that night as a last-minute replacement for a fellow employee who had gotten sick. Davis was a big man, not just tall, but heavily muscled as well. And as chance, or perhaps fate, would have it, he outweighed the regularly scheduled guard by a good 50 pounds. That meant the tranquilizer dose that had been prepared for the original guard wasn't strong enough to keep Davis under for long. certainly not long enough for the intruders to accomplish their goal. He woke shortly after being shot. Davis had been trained well. As he slowly came back to consciousness, he stayed where he was, lying face down in the grass, and didn't try to sit up or attempt to discover what had happened. The details didn't matter. What mattered was letting the rest of the team know that they were under attack. And he needed to do it without attracting undue attention to himself, in case the enemy was out there watching. His arms had been flung out over his head when he fell, and that proved to be an unexpected godsend. Moving just half an inch or so at a time, he slowly slid his right hand over to his left until his fingers came in contact with the band of his watch. The military timepiece had a panic button built into its face. Pressing it sent a high-frequency signal to the main security station, letting the man on duty there know that something was amiss. Davis searched for the button. The spotter in the trees scanned the grounds with his sighting scope.
Son of a... Target, Sector B, from TRP-1, right 50, add 25.
His partner brought his weapon into position.
Roger. Movement on the ground. Second target from the left.
The shooter adjusted his grip on the stock of his weapon. The tranquilizer dart gun had been set aside just moments before and been replaced with his standard piece, a Parker Hale M85 rifle. Taking a deep breath, he held it for a moment, making sure he was on target. The sniper shot was true. It struck Davis in the head, killing him instantly. But the sniper had been about a quarter of a second too late. Davis had already found the panic button and mashed it down flat. In the library on the first floor, the celebration continued. Davenport cracked open a bottle of cognac, and drinks were passed around. He raised his glass, waiting until the others followed suit.
A toast, then, to our expedition.
Hear, hear.
Hear, hear.
Anya cast a questioning look at her companions.
We've got an intruder.
Mason crossed the room and disappeared through the door. Davenport and Anya quickly followed. Out in the hallway, they found Mason surrounded by a handful of hard-looking men who had apparently appeared out of thin air. Or at least it seemed that way to Anya, who up until now hadn't even seen a hint that a security team was present, never mind active. A tall black man was helping Mason slip into a ballistic vest.
Sit rep.
We've got a breach along the south wall. Davis's panic button went off just over 60 seconds ago. I tripped the alarm and assembled the team as per SOP.
Good job, Jeffries. Any idea who or what we're up against?
Nah, motion sensors never went off, which means the video feed wasn't activated. At this point, all we have is the lack of response from Carter and the active signal from Davis, which doesn't tell us a whole hell of a lot.
Mason turned to face Davenport.
Without knowing what we're facing, I have to suggest that you take cover in the secure room until this is all over, sir.
The trusted friend had reverted back into loyal employee, Anya noted. One of the security team members stepped to Davenport's side, gun drawn and eyes on alert. He indicated the hallway to the left.
This way, sir.
Anya chose to follow Davenport. Besides, if he was the target, at least she was there to protect him. She was halfway down the hall when a sudden thought stopped her dead in her tracks.
The journal. Whoever they are, they're after the journal.
Turning, she charged back down the hall.
Anya, wait!
She hit the staircase and took the steps two at a time, her gaze directed above, watching for intruders. When she reached the second floor landing, she flattened herself against the wall, settled into a crouch, and peeked around the corner at knee height. If someone was there, she didn't want to stick her face right in their sights. The hall was empty, however.
Anya!
She spun around to find Davenport coming up the steps, his bodyguard a few steps behind, and obviously not very happy about the current situation. Anya wasn't either. She silenced him with a sharp wave of her hand and gestured for him to join her against the wall.
What are you doing? Mason told us to get undercover.
We need to check on Curran's diary.
You don't think...
Yeah, I do think. Now stay here and let me check things out.
Anya turned to look at the bodyguard.
Make sure he listens, understand?
The security agent nodded. She straightened up and took a deep breath. Rounding the corner, she headed for the room at the end of the hall at a fast walk, doing her best to be as quiet as possible. She'd made it about halfway there when the door at the end opened and a man clad in dark clothing stepped out. Anya could clearly see the automatic weapon he carried. The closest door was behind her. He'd see her long before she could reverse course, get it open, and slip inside. If that happened, she was as good as dead. She had to reach him first. The intruder turned. Anya dropped into a slide, her sword thrust upward. The blade caught him low in the gut, just under the edge of his Kevlar vest, pinning him to the door. He stared at her in disbelief, looking down at the 2 feet of steel sticking out of his gut, then died without saying a word. Rather than try to pull her sword free, Anya simply released it into the otherwhere.
Anya!
The bullets had missed her, but that didn't mean they hadn't found a target. John Davenport was kneeling in the middle of the hallway, cradling the badly wounded body of his security agent. The other man's neck stained a deep crimson hue. Anya met Davenport's gaze. The slight shake of his head said it all. There was nothing they could do.
Get the journal. At least make his death count for something.
Anya had no idea how many men were waiting for her on the other side of the door, nor how they were armed. She was going to have to trust that her instincts and her speed were going to be enough. She pictured the room in her mind, trying to remember the arrangement of the furniture, considering what might provide adequate cover and what would not. Anya dove through the open door, tucked and rolled, ending up behind a large island work area that was built into the floor. She peeked around the opposite side, looking for the gunman. Under the table where she'd worked all day, she could see the shattered remains of the glass case that had held the diary, but there was no sign of the intruder. Nor was there any sign of the diary. She scuttled over to the other side and peeked around the edge, ready to jerk her head back at the slightest sign of movement. The gunfire had come from somewhere. The door she'd come through was the only exit from the room, and she knew that no one had gotten past her to go through it.
Where on earth did they go?
She looked up just in time to see a dark-clad form disappear through a hole cut in the ceiling. Anya stood, intending to chase after them, but the intruder stuck his weapon back down through the hole. Anya waited several seconds after the firing stopped to be certain the shooter wasn't just changing clips. When the shooting failed to resume, she rose to her feet and raced over to the rope that still hung down through the hole. She was betting that the intruders would be more concerned with getting out of there as quickly as possible, and wouldn't have posted anyone to stand guard at the top. She grabbed the rope and shimmied up as quickly as she could, knowing that if she guessed wrong, she was a sitting duck. Luckily, she hadn't. When she poked her head out through the hole in the roof, she saw 3 figures running away from her across the rooftop, headed for the wing closest to the outer wall of the property. Anya pulled herself onto the roof and gave chase. Mason led his men through the house and gathered them together in the underground garage, where they assembled into 2 squads, one to be led by him and the other to be led by his second-in-command, Jeffries. There were 2 emergency evacuation vehicles standing ready at all times in the garage in case Davenport had to be taken to safety on a moment's notice, and Mason intended to put them to good use. The SUVs were armor-plated and came equipped with reinforced steering, puncture-resistant tires, and bulletproof glass throughout. They were adequate protection against just about anything short of a rocket-propelled grenade, and would provide good cover while they crossed the estate grounds and tried to get a look at whoever it was that had breached their security. The men climbed into the vehicles, and Mason gave the signal to move out. Lights from the outdoor floodlights that had been triggered by the alarm flooded into the garage as the gates were opened by remote from inside the vehicles. And then they were climbing the sloping driveway up to ground level. They came under fire almost immediately. Mason ignored it, confident that the armor would hold up. Still, the well-trained driver did what he could to avoid taking too many hits. It didn't take a rocket scientist to figure out why Davis and Catter had dropped off the grid. The fact that he had 2 men down, condition unknown, bothered him, but Mason was too good a commander to give in to the urge to move right to their side. His first order of business was to protect Davenport and secure the property. His men would have to hold on until he could get to them. When Davis's panic button went off, its GPS signal put him out in front of the house near the wall. An access road ran around the inside of the fence line, but to save time, the driver cut directly across the front lawn, his tires tearing long furrows out of the grass. Muzzle flashes could be seen along the wall and in the tree line just beyond, and Mason made note of their position, then relayed that information to those in the back seat. They would be in range in just another minute or two, and he could feel his troops getting themselves ready.
He picked the wrong team to screw with.
As they drew closer, their headlights picked out a dark shape on the grass, a man's body. Mason pointed it out to the driver, who skewed the vehicle to a stop, angled between the downed man and the grass, and the line of fire coming from beyond the wall. No sooner had the vehicle slammed to a stop than Mason was slipping out the door and rushing over to the man's side. The rest of his men opened the doors on the other side, crouched behind them, and returned fire. The man on the ground had red hair, tatter. Mason reached for the man's neck and checked for a pulse. Thankfully, he found one, strong and steady, too. But when he went to remove his hand, it brushed against something sticking out of Catter's neck. Mason rolled the man over and let his head loll back, revealing the object sticking out of the side of Catter's throat just below the ear.
Tranquilize a dart.
The sight of it froze him in place for a moment.
What on earth are they doing using a dart gun? Unless...
The gunfire was just a distraction. Mason spun around, looking back at the house, and was just in time to see a group of figures running along the peak of the roof. A moment later, the lithe figure of Anya Creed climbed out onto the roof after them and gave chase. The roof was relatively flat, but the tiles were worn smooth from years of summer rainstorms, and more than a few popped free beneath Anya's feet as she took off after the intruders. Anya saw the last man in the group glance back in her direction, but he didn't stop moving forward, and neither did she. Anya could see Mason and his men working their way across the lawn toward the south wall, using two large SUVs from the motor pool as cover. Return fire was coming at them from the tree line, but so far it looked pretty ineffectual. The intruders had reached the edge of the roof and were starting to make their descent by the time Anya reached the edge of the south wing. One of them looked back in her direction, saw that she had closed the distance between them, and decided she'd come far enough. He snatched up his gun. Anya dove to the left, rolling across the tiles. By the time she scrambled back to her feet, two of the three intruders had already disappeared over the edge, headed for the ground below. As she watched, the last of the trio took hold of the rope and got into position for his own descent. He gave her a jaunty smile and a wink before starting down the rope. Anya flung herself forward, her arms outstretched. She struck the rooftop and slid toward the edge. Her feet caught on the edge of one of the tiles, stopping her slide. Her hand went over the edge of the roof, and she grabbed the leader's wrist.
Gotcha.
His gun was slung over his shoulder, and his other hand grasped the rope to keep from falling to the ground. As she struggled to pull him up toward her, he did something totally unexpected. He let go of the rope. Anya's arm nearly popped out of the socket. She was forced to release her grip on the tiles and grab his arm with both hands. Grinning, her opponent dipped his free shoulder, causing his rifle to slide down into his hand. As she watched, he got a better grip on the butt of the weapon, stuck his finger on the trigger, and swung the muzzle up in her direction. The sudden motion shifted their weight a fraction to one side. Anya's foot popped off the tile that braced it. She tumbled only 10 feet or so before crashing onto the balcony jutting out below them. Her opponent lost his weapon in the fall, but managed to land on his feet. He immediately kicked her in the gut. That cleared her head. She blocked the second hit with both hands, catching his foot in the process, twisting it savagely to one side in an attempt to throw him off balance. Rather than toppling to the ground, the assault leader turned in the direction of her throw and came back at her head with his other foot. They exchanged a flurry of blows, neither of them managing to land anything damaging, until he overextended himself on a spinning sidekick and she was able to drop beneath it and sweep his feet out from under him. As he fell to the ground, she sprung back to her feet and closed in. But rather than getting to his feet, he placed both his hands flat on the ground and shoved his body up and out. He slammed his feet into her chest, sending her stumbling backward. This time, there was nothing between her and the ground.